The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. I'd like to welcome to the program today Richard Sandomir. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Vic. How are you?
Excellent, Richard. I've always wanted to interview you, and I finally have an opportunity because you have a book that just came out in paperback, and it's called The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. Now, this is a very unusual subject. What made you decide to write about this?
Well, I've always liked the movie The Pride of the Yankees, and I was reading a biography of Samuel Goldwyn, the producer of the movie, and it was just, it's a story told by Scott Berg in less than a page about how Goldwyn, a Polish immigrant who did not like baseball, knew nothing about sports, he was persuaded to sit in his screening room and watch the newsreels of Gehrig delivering his classic Luckiest Man on the Face of the Earth speech between games of a doubleheader on July 4, 1939. It was his story editor, Niven Bush, a baseball fan, who persuaded him, after failing to persuade him to make a movie about Gehrig, he said, okay, I'm going to show him the newsreel. So the newsreel ends, and Goldwyn is sitting there weeping. He said, run it again. It runs through, and Goldwyn says, get Jim Mulvey, who was his number two guy, let's make a deal with Eleanor Gehrig. And Goldwyn knew nothing about baseball, but he understood emotion. He understood, after being told more of the story of Gehrig, that Gehrig was a great ball player, which Goldwyn could care less about, but he showed this great strength and courage in the face of having ALS, and he had a great love story with his wife, Eleanor. This kind of stuff is what Goldwyn understood. He understood movies, emotional movies like Stella Dallas that he made. So I thought if I could bring the full story to the public, I'd be satisfying my curiosity, and I thought I'd have a good book. And it took quite a while to not only get a book proposal done, but also once that was accepted, to convince the Goldwyn estate to let me into their archive, because there wasn't much primary material out there. I guess I could have done a book just on old clips. There was nobody to interview. Everybody's dead. Mm. So I had to go where the information I hoped would be. And in that archive was probably 70% of my book, old scripts, letters, contracts. One of the most amazing things was the transcript of interviews between Eleanor and Paul Gallico, who would later be known as the author of The Poseidon Adventure, but who had been a sports writer and a sports editor. And he wrote the first outline and script of Pride of the Yankees. So these 38 pages of interviews with Eleanor really helped set the tone for the movie, and it showed how involved she was in influencing the movie. Not always successfully, but she was there. She was sending letters to Goldwyn saying, now, this script, it's wrong. You can't do this. You can't say he hit four home runs in a World Series game. You can't say that Lou's parents were at our wedding. They weren't. But if you want to do it, go ahead. So I sensed that there would be a great story, and I'm glad to say there was.
We probably have a few listeners out there who are like the movie mogul Goldwyn, and they don't actually know who Lou Gehrig is. They think he's just the name of a disease. Who was Lou Gehrig?
Well, Lou Gehrig was one of the greatest baseball players of all time, certainly one of the two or three greatest of his era. He was the first baseman for the Yankees. He was a great slugger. He was a very shy guy who played most of his career in the shadow of the not very shy at all Babe Ruth. And he was just a very, very decent, very quiet guy who just was perhaps the best first baseman of all time, who at barely 36 years old was suddenly realized that his body wasn't responding the way it should have. He was making errors. He wasn't hitting as well. His 1938 season was good by other people's standards, but not by his. And by spring training of 1939, he could barely do anything. He could barely lean over to catch a ball. He couldn't hit anything. He played a few games during the 1939 season and then told the manager of the Yankees, Joe McCarthy, that he couldn't go any further. This is May 2nd, 1939. He went to the Mayo Clinic in June, diagnosed with ALS, made his farewell to baseball and pretty much to the world in between games of a doubleheader against the Washington Senators. And while he traveled with the team that year, his physical condition was getting worse and worse. He worked for the New York City Parole Commission until after the 39 season, until he could no longer really move on his own. And he died with his wife and his mother-in-law attending to him in his house in the Bronx.
Richard Sandomir joins me. His book is The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. And as we read the book, we learn how the casting of Gary Cooper as Lou Gehrig in the film was really probably the most important part of the whole thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Goldwyn understood that you didn't need an athlete to play Lou Gehrig because there wasn't going to be much baseball in there. And Cooper was in the last picture of a deal with Goldwyn. They had a kind of a fractious relationship that went up and down. They both benefited from their mutual association, but Goldwyn knew he had the right guy there, a man who was known for playing roles of men of quiet dignity. And that's pretty much what Gehrig was. And at the suggestion of the gossip columnist Luella Parsons, they did sort of a phony baloney casting call through postcards, through the Sporting News magazine, through Cosmopolitan, through Gallup poll was helping out, trying to figure out who should play him. Well, you know, you got Eddie Albert, Cary Grant, you know, all sorts of people were nominated, got voted on in various ways. Even Babe Ruth was suggested as someone to play Lou Gehrig, which was absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, at first glance, somebody like Eddie Albert doesn't seem like even the silliest kind of casting decisions. But Eddie Albert was a damn good actor. He would become a war hero. He was kind of a lot of singing and dancing, but he really wasn't that well known in 1941. And he would be a war hero later on. But when the phony baloney casting was done in the summer and fall of 41, it was kind of a just a publicity stunt. And around Christmas of 41, Cooper, to nobody's surprise, was named as the actor to play Gehrig.
Richard, if I had to pick a favorite section of the book, I would pick a section, because I'm a big baseball fan, the part where Lefty O'Doul teaches Gary Cooper how to look like a plausible Lou Gehrig. This is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, Lefty O'Doul was a great ball player. He was a National League batting champion and a manager in the high minor leagues out on the West Coast. And he helped bring baseball to Japan. He was a character, and he was also a great batting coach. The problem with Cooper is not that he couldn't act. He could do all that. But the memory of Gehrig's athletic achievements were still very, very, they still resonated with fans. So they needed to make him even a mediocre facsimile of a ball player. But Cooper was a right-hander. He had never played baseball in his life. He grew up in Montana and for a little while in England. He knew how to ride a horse. He knew how to box. He knew how to hunt. Didn't know how to play ball. So for 6 weeks, O'Doul tutored him to help him learn how to bat. They adapted the action of swinging an axe, which Cooper was familiar with, and they drilled. You know, they drilled over and over. And if you watch the movie, Cooper is mediocre. You never, except for one sequence where he's hitting balls in an arcade in Santa Monica, you never really see the ball hitting the bat. You hear the sound, but the camera cuts away. And the and it wasn't always Cooper seen in the movie. It was the for long shots and a sequence in the minor leagues, you see the back and side of Babe Herman, the Brooklyn Dodgers first baseman, and you'd see cutaways to Cooper. So Cooper was protected from embarrassing himself. Now, when you see him swing, it's not Lou Gehrig's swing. Cooper had a lean, lanky body, and Gehrig was a muscle-bound guy. Mm-hmm. And there has been a story told ever since 1941-42 that Cooper failed at being able to bat lefty, and so the negative of the film was flipped.
Uh-huh.
That, to my mind, and through the work of a Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame senior curator named Tom Schieber, that is not true, at least not in the final cut of the film. Because if you're going to flip the negative, then you have to have everybody on the field in on it. Everybody has to wear their uniform name backwards.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to look like you're running to first, you have to run to third. You have to do so many things. And Tom Schieber debunked that, except for the sequence in the minor leagues where it's just a two-minute montage where Cooper is throwing, and it's very clear that the hardest thing to do in all that was learning how to throw as a left-hander. So the negative was flipped. There could have been a lot more flipping left on the cutting room floor, but we don't know anything about that. That said, the final product, Cooper doesn't look awful. He doesn't look like Gehrig. But at most, there's 10 to 12 minutes of baseball action in the entire film. So whatever he did pales in comparison to how he delivered the Luckiest Man speech and to the charisma between he and Teresa Wright, who played Eleanor.
I love that urban legend about flipping the film, because I can remember being back in Little League and I hadn't thought about it since. And people were saying, oh, yeah, they flipped the film because Cooper, mm-hmm. Cooper was right-handed and Lou was a southpaw. And here it was in your book. The Book Nook will continue right after this. We're halfway through the baseball season, and we're talking baseball. It's the Book Nook. Babe Ruth, of course, is a big part of the Yankees, the biggest part, and mm-hmm. Gehrig lived in his shadow, and his shadow continued to be there even after Gehrig died, and Babe was involved in the film, and Lou's widow wasn't particularly keen on this, was she?
No, and you know, think of the movie without Babe Ruth. It doesn't work as well. Babe had a good understanding of how to play Babe. He was in some silent movies, and you know, he was kind of an actor acting out his own life anyway. So there was friction between Babe and Lou and Eleanor and Eleanor and Babe. The source of it is not necessarily known for sure, whether there had been an affair between Eleanor and Babe, or there was some problem caused by Lou's mother criticizing the way Claire Ruth dressed one of her daughters. At that point, it didn't matter. All that matters is that Eleanor told Goldwyn and her agent, Christy Walsh, that Babe was a scene stealer, that her husband had lived in Babe's shadow in life. Cooper was not going to continue to be in his shadow every time Babe was on screen. I don't think she thought she was going to win that argument. She said, well, never have him alone on screen. And there's very little need to have had him alone on screen. So he was always in a group or with Lou or with Cooper. But she really felt that he would ruin things and that he would just be a scene hog. The fact is that not only did he know how to play himself, he fit in very well. There's one scene where after the Yankees win the World Series and the Yankees are heading home in a train car, a train from I think St. Louis, and the team is celebrating, everybody's drinking. And I don't know whether the director told Babe to just let loose, but there's a point where the camera does a close-up of Babe, and Babe is screaming something totally unintelligible. And, you know, he's having a ball. He loved being in this movie. He had been kind of forgotten to a certain degree. Nobody wanted him to be a manager. He became an ordinary person who played a lot of golf and bowled a lot. And so here he was back with some of his old teammates in a talkie, because he'd been in silence. And what isn't seen in that scene is that the Babe got so rambunctious that he bashed in one of the train windows and needed to be hospitalized because he broke some blood vessels. So he was bandaged up. It was the second time he went to the hospital during the making of the film. He had kind of compromised his health before he came to Hollywood by losing a lot of weight in order to play a younger Babe Ruth. He lost about 50 pounds in a short period of time. And at a certain point, he was weak, and he had pneumonia. He was off the set for about 2 weeks. But once he got a little healthier, he was milking it. You'd see the camera, photographers came in and shot pictures of him in his smoking jacket and his bathrobe. And he didn't have, it's a terry cloth bathrobe. He had a lovely, I think, paisley number. He just had a great time. There are numerous publicity photos of him sitting at Wrigley Field in Los Angeles getting his hair retouched or getting makeup. He had his old friends like John Barrymore to go out and have fun with. So he was almost reliving his days of being the Babe Ruth of the New York Yankees.
Poor Babe. I felt kind of sad for him reading your book when you talk about after he left baseball, and he was really kind of a forgotten man. You talk about him sitting in the stands and being ignored, and we think of him being so much larger than life and so wild and the heavy drinker and the incredible star. And then Lou Gehrig living quietly in his shadow, and we think of Lou Gehrig as such a straight arrow. And I learned something from your book where apparently Lou had a little period there where he was dipping into the sauce a little bit, and they thought about putting that into the movie.
Yeah, he had a period in the minor leagues where, and again, this became a debate over whether to include such a scene in the movie, he went on a bender. And that was kind of reinterpreted many times in the script about whether to have him go up to the plate drunk. And, that was deemed not to be appropriate in the end. But, yeah, in fact, Eleanor said he had some problems with road rage. Can't imagine that. He wasn't a straight arrow all the time, just most of the time.
Yeah,
I mean, he was just such a, again, he actually was a very decent guy. And Babe, I think, was very well-intentioned. I think Babe, at his heart, was a very good guy, but he was wild. By 1941, 42, he wasn't the wild man anymore. And within a few years, he would get seriously ill. But one of the last things he did publicly was attend the premiere of the Babe Ruth story, which learned none of the lessons of Pride of the Yankees. It was an absolutely awful movie that if he weren't dying at that point, it might have killed him. But it was just a dreadful film.
I love the anecdote you have in there about Lou's brief binge where he was going up to the plate and he was drunk and he was seeing three balls coming at him and he swung at one of them and it went out of the park.
Yeah, that sounds like an anecdote that should have been attached to the Babe, and it probably did happen to the Babe, but we almost don't believe it happened to Lou.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the speech. July 4th is just around the corner. The speech is so iconic, and Gary Cooper really owns that speech, doesn't he?
Yeah, he really does. In large part, well, there are two reasons. Because the movie has taken its place in the canon of American movies, and you see it every, it's been on local TV, it's on the MLB Network, it's on TCM, it's available on video, and also because the newsreel recording of the speech has not been preserved, except for I think four different lines, including the most important line, the luckiest man line. It just doesn't exist anymore, as far as we know, and not only is there just a few bits of the newsreel left, as far as we know, there is no audio, or never has been. See, the problem with all that is that even though Lou and Eleanor prepared for him to speak, it wasn't announced that he was going to speak. So there was no radio recording, as far as I know, and there was no actual copy of the speech He went up there with nothing in hand on a hot, humid afternoon on July 4th. His body was already showing the effects of ALS. You know, the muscle mass was declining. He had lost weight. The uniform was billowing on him. Those were the days where uniforms were not tight, but you could tell that this is a man who had, since 1938, had been affected by ALS, although not diagnosed till 39. So he goes up there with nothing. The emotion is overwhelming him. He has something to say, but he's very reluctant when his time comes to speak. And mind you, Eleanor told several different stories over the years about the provenance of the speech, that they wrote it down, they didn't write it down, they took notes, they didn't take notes, they rehearsed it, they didn't rehearse it, they wrote it together, he wrote it himself. The fact is that when he went up there, he delivered a marvelous speech. We don't know exactly what he said from start to finish with any great accuracy. We do know that he started off by saying, I had a bad break, but today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. But because reporters weren't prepared for it, nobody was transcribing it as if they knew there would be something important to say. So all the newspaper reports were all around the place. Some of them couldn't even render the luckiest man line correctly. Mm-hmm. So, but by the end of it, people are really, really affected by it. Eleanor, when the movie was being made, Eleanor presented a copy of the speech to Goldwyn, saying, "You should, it should be acted out exactly with this. Cooper should say exactly this." Now, we don't know if that really was the original copy of the speech, or whether she cobbled together what she remembered. It probably is pretty close to what he said because it has a great rhythm to it. It almost feels like one of his sports writer friends might have written it for them, mm-hmm. because it has, a lot of lovely rhetorical touches besides the luckiest man line, that, and all the thanking of his parents, his mother-in-law, the New York Giants, his managers, the president of the Yankees, Ed Barrow, the ushers. It was an extraordinary speech, and it almost seemed like when he stepped away from the microphone after delivering it that he thought he might have had something to say, but he was too overwhelmed to say it. When the screenwriters rewrote the speech, they moved the luckiest man line to the end, which was appropriate because it is the best line, and it's very dramatic, and it's very memorable at the end. Mm-hmm. But they shortened it. Cooper thanks fewer people. But Cooper owns it because he took some stuff out of Gehrig's, how Gehrig enacted it, how Gehrig delivered it, and you see the eyes glistening and tearing up. You see him kind of brushing his face with his hand, much as Gehrig did. But it's still Cooper's version of it. It's still Cooper bringing his acting chops to it, and it was. And this is the speech that we see over and over and over. And it is, I think it was very well rewritten. It goes from like 270 words to 180 in the movie. But it really is, it's a great rendition that I think that's the speech that people remember when they're referring to it.
Mm. My guest is Richard Sandomir. His book, The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic, just came out in paperback just in time for the 4th of July and the anniversary of that incredible speech, that last public appearance by Lou Gehrig. And she doesn't get her name in the title of the book, but this is very much the story of his widow, Eleanor Gehrig, and her devotion to his memory and to him. And I think my favorite line in the book is, when Lefty Old Duel describes Gary Cooper's throwing, he says, "You throw a ball like an old woman tossing a hot biscuit." That was good. And then at the end, the epilogue, Cooper says goodbye. I did not realize that Gary Cooper died that young. And there's a Friars Club roast that you recount that was his last public appearance. And this is pretty amazing to read about.
Yeah, it was January of 61, about a little less than 2 weeks before JFK's inauguration. The Friars have a charity roast for Cooper in the Beverly Hilton Hotel. and much of old Hollywood is there. You got Jack Warner and Goldwyn. You got Audrey Hepburn, Greer Garson, Milton Berle, Tony Martin, Dean Martin, Georgie Jessel, and for some reason Carl Sandburg, who was friendly with Cooper's father, who's a lawyer and judge out in California. And, you know, it was a fairly gentle roast. Everybody knew Cooper was sick. He had, I think it was prostate cancer that had by now spread to his bones. And Cooper, much accustomed to reading, you know, to delivering scripts, worked with Billy Wilder on his speech. The only non-tame person there was Milton Berle, who was completely unhinged in his part of the roast. Audrey Hepburn was loving, and you know, Tony Martin sang a politically incorrect song. Mm-hmm. But it was when Cooper got up to speak, and this is the reason why I quoted from this, why I used the roast at all. So, towards the end of the speech, which is very modest and dignified, as befitting Cooper, he uses or adapts the Luckiest Man speech and the other verbal memory of him in movies. Now, he was known as a very kind of terse cowboy character in many of his films, and for saying yep a lot. Mm-hmm. People probably remembered him saying it more than he actually did, but it resonated because it was part of several people's roasts of him that night. And so at the very end, he says, well, if anybody, I think this is something like, if anybody thinks I'm the luckiest man in the world, I say, yep. that was that.
Yeah.
So I found this recording online one day when I was in Beverly Hills, where the Goldwyn Archives are. But on the Wednesday of each week, they close up. So I'm sitting in my hotel room doing some research, and I come across this. And the only person who I needed to interview for the book is Cooper's daughter, Maria. And she was very helpful in telling me various things about Cooper's life, but she would have been too young to tell me about the movie. So I called her up, and I said, oh, my God, I just found this online. Do you know about it? She said, no about it. I was there. She was like 20 or 21 at the time. And I said, oh, great. Tell me about it. Well, we were sitting at a table, and the place was crowded, and she just, you know, she went through all the various details. And I said to her, well, did your father know he was dying at that point? And this really struck me. She said, no, my mother hadn't told him yet. He knew he wasn't well. He probably figured he wasn't, you know, going in a positive direction. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's kind of what Eleanor Gehrig did with Lou. And she said, yeah, it was. Mm. She said, I don't think my mother got it from her. But and I thought, okay, well, there's an interesting connection there. And but, you know, to listen to this old world Hollywood roast with the mostly gentle jibes at Cooper for being as terse as he was, and then hearing the connection to Pride of the Yankees, there are very few things that he said in movies that people remember.
Mm-hmm.
He gave some speeches in other films, but they didn't resonate, or they were just a little too complex to boil down to the luckiest man on the face of the earth. So, you know, here's a guy who, you know, 20 years after making the film, is using a line to sum up his life. That's mm-hmm. pretty good. Now, about a year and a half after the movie came out, he went to the South Pacific with a USO troop. And one day in Port Moresby, and mind you, this is like monsoon season, so it's raining. And one of the GIs, you know, and Cooper went there. He was doing comedy. He was doing Jack Benny routines.
Mm.
And one of the GIs says, hey, Coop, how about the Gehrig speech? They had apparently seen the movie while they were, you know, wherever you showed movies to troops during wartime. And he said, well, give me a few minutes, you know. Obviously, he didn't go around doing the speech. And he sat down, took notes with water coming, you know, pouring on his neck because the tent he was in was not fully covered. And he comes out and delivers the speech. And it's kind of a wartime speech, and that's how Goldwyn wanted it to be viewed. He had Damon Runyon do a scroll at the beginning of the film that sort of placed Gehrig among the lost early in the war. The several thousand GIs sitting in front of Cooper in the rain were silent. And on every subsequent stop on the tour, I think 20 different islands, and ending up in Sydney, Australia, he delivered the speech. So he did make greater movies, but can you remember a line from High Noon? Maybe a big High Noon fan can, but you know it hasn't transcended the movie world into another realm.
Just one of the great stories in this book. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, my guest has been Richard Sandomir. His book is The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and The Making of a Classic, just out in paperback. And before I let you go, Richard, I want to note that every day when I pick up my New York Times, I don't read the front page. I don't read the sports section. The first section I go to is the obituaries.
That's good to hear.
And I see your work there. You are currently, you've been at the New York Times for a long time, but you are currently on the obituaries desk, and you write great obituaries.
I'd covered sports media and sports business for 25 years, and it's a long time to cover one subject, even though there's obviously an evolution in what's happened in sports media. But yeah, the story started getting very, very much the same. Mm. And I moved into obituaries right around the time I was finishing up with the book. And in a way, each obituary is a mini book because you got to do a very quick, deep immersion into someone's life, finding articles, oral histories, interviews, talking to family members, to experts, and you deliver a mini biography in 1 or 2 days. So it's a very appealing job to not only to just the process is interesting, but the diversity of people that I write about is interesting. So I'm writing about a weightlifter today. I wrote about a golfer yesterday. And, I could write about a physicist tomorrow. So it's an amazingly diverse area because you just never know who I'm going to be assigned to do. You never know who's going to die.
Yeah.
And, there's an endless every day there's kind of a regeneration of, continuously interesting people.
You never run out of material.
No, you never do. Yeah. And it is it's just a fascinating daily process.
Well, Richard, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Vic.
And it was really a pleasure to talk to Richard Sandomir about his book, The Pride of the Yankees, in the Book Nook. And we've got a little extra time for you. Don't touch that dial. I've got a Book Nook bonus coming up for you right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. And in our final segment, I've got a Book Nook bonus for you. We heard from Richard Sandomir during the first two segments of the program this morning, talking about his book, The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. And as I mentioned to Richard at the end of our conversation, I love reading the obituaries in the New York Times. They are so beautifully written and so informative. Every day I learn about somebody I'd never heard of. And if you admire the writing in the obituaries, Richard Sandomir is one of the great obituary writers for the New York Times. He's been there at the Times for many years, but only recently went over to the obituaries desk. And I want to read you an excerpt from his book, The Pride of the Yankees, just to give you some sense of the great writing in this book. It's the story of Gary Cooper trying to learn how to play baseball and look like Lou Gehrig in the movie. Here's from the book. Cooper, a sophisticated man who was one of the highest paid actors in Hollywood, may not have been overwhelmed by the unfamiliar surroundings, but he nonetheless fretted over whether he could play the sport even for the modest amount of time required by the script. Anything outside Yankee pinstripes would be easy and familiar. Romantic scenes with Teresa Wright or those where he tried to break away from overbearing Mom Gehrig. But Cooper had no natural baseball IQ. His scene as a pitcher turned hobo in the movie Doe, in which his chronically painful right shoulder made his motion awkward when he fired imaginary pitches to Walter Brennan, his unshaven sidekick, impressed no one. Cooper's athleticism was embodied in being a skilled horseman, a talent natural to his upbringing in Montana. In silent movies, he was a trick rider who specialized in falling off horses, despite a hip that had been broken but never set after a car accident when he was a teenager. He needed help that he could not find in the script. It wasn't a baseball movie, but Cooper needed to learn enough baseball to be credible with a bat or glove in his hands. He could not wear Gehrig's number 4 and play like a klutz. So, in the 6 weeks leading up to the filming, he took classes in batting, fielding, throwing, and sliding from Lefty O'Doul, a former National League batting champion who was managing the San Francisco Seals, a rival of the Angels in the mighty Pacific Coast League. If O'Doul's tutelage didn't pay off, Cooper would likely embarrass himself and hurt box office receipts if baseball fans shunned pride. While the bar may not have been set very high for actors playing athletes in the early 1940s, Cooper had to show reasonable aptitude on the field. Some critics were still raising their doubts about Cooper's baseball competence, perhaps to demonstrate their loyalty to Gehrig's memory. The Tinseltown gossip columnist Jimmy Fiddler wrote, without showing proof, "Baseball fans and writers are protesting Gary Cooper as Lou Gehrig on the screen because Lou was left-handed and Gary isn't." Cooper's lack of affinity for playing baseball came naturally. During 3 of his formative years out west, his parents sent him and his older brother Arthur to live in England to learn to become young gentlemen and cast off the wildness of their Montana boyhood. He returned at age 12. "When I came back to Montana, the other kids were so far ahead of me at playing ball, I just never got started and stuck to football and track instead," Cooper recalled. Helena was also 1,500 miles west of St. Louis, Major League Baseball's westernmost market, making it inaccessible to Cooper in the time before radio unified the nation. Cooper tried to be diligent even when he and O'Doul were apart. At a dinner party at his house with Jack Benny, his wife Mary Livingstone, and the stars Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor, who were married to each other, Cooper picked up a glass ashtray and tossed it from his left hand to his right, then returned it to his left. "Do it all the time from force of habit," he told writer Harry Evans, who was one of the guests. "I have to practice throwing with my left hand." O'Doul, the benefactor of that persistence, was suited to play the coach of a Hollywood star. He loved the limelight, and he loved hitting. "When I was playing ball in the big leagues, my bats would be jumping up and down the trunk," he said. "Couldn't wait to get to the ballpark, grab that bat. Big crowd, sock a triple, nothing like it. Maybe I was a ham. What's the use of doing something when nobody's looking but a packed ballpark crowd roaring? The guy throws you a great breaking curve. You hit it on the nose and drive it over the outfielder's head. What a thrill!" Frank Joseph O'Doul, whose memorable wardrobe earned him the nickname "the man in the green suit," started as a pitcher for the Yankees, but he was never very good at it. One day, with his arm injured, he announced to his Salt Lake City Bees minor league manager, "I am now an outfielder," and so became a prolific left-handed hitter who finished his major league career with a .349 batting average, the 4th best in baseball history. He did not have enough great years to be elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, but in a span of 4 seasons, he hit .398, .383, and .368. In that in-between year, he hit .336. "If I had to do it all over," he said, "I'd be a ball player again without pay. Yeah, without pay. I loved it. That's why I never squawked when I didn't get big salaries. I like to play too much." Cooper presented an unusual challenge for O'Doul, who adeptly schooled minor leaguers in the Pacific Coast League and players in Japan during trips to the country in the years before and after World War II. He is credited with giving the Tokyo Giants their name and helping to create the first Japanese baseball league. Now came Cooper, a dapper 6-foot-2-inch cowboy with a bum hip, a right arm he couldn't raise above his shoulder, and no sandlot games in his childhood. O'Doul's mission was not just to teach him baseball in a few weeks, but to turn the right-handed actor into a decent left-handed facsimile of Henry Louis Gehrig. "No mean feat in itself," Cooper said. Perhaps Cooper's ignorance of how to play baseball worked in his favor when O'Doul began his classes. He did not have to alter any bad habits, because he had none, save for his poor throwing in Meet John Doe. But among all the skills in sports, hitting a round ball with a long cylindrical bat is the hardest. Harder still, if you're a right-hander learning from scratch and trying to imitate one of the greatest left-handed players ever. Greatness was not an option for Cooper. Mediocrity was a reasonable goal. "If that Cooper doesn't get in there and play ball like Gehrig," O'Doul said, probably overstating his worries, "I'm going to be in the doghouse for sure." After seeing Cooper throw, O'Doul's verdict was sharp and negative. "You throw a ball like an old woman tossing a hot biscuit," O'Doul said. O'Doul could not have been thrilled to watch Cooper hit, either. He had no muscle memory for hitting, and none of the hand-eye coordination that is critical to making contact with a ball. But O'Doul developed a plan, maybe just for Cooper specifically, or perhaps adapted from how he helped his players recover from slumps. The lessons took place mostly behind Cooper's Brentwood mansion, before the filming of Pride began. A luxurious spring training site where the neighbors were Tyrone Power, Cesar Romero, Frank Capra, William Wellman, Van Johnson, and film editor J. Watson Webb, an heir to the Vanderbilt and Havermeyer fortunes. Cooper learned to throw left-handed by tossing pebbles, then larger rocks, before graduating to baseballs. O'Doul had him bowl and hit a boxer's speed bag with his left hand. For hitting, O'Doul reasoned the batting stroke was close enough to chopping wood, so he instructed Cooper to hit by comparing the action of a Louisville slugger to that of an axe. Fortunately, the right-handed Cooper chopped wood naturally from his left side. Photographs show O'Doul taking Cooper through his wood-chopping batting lessons while attired in 40s Hollywood casual, collared shirts, sweaters tucked into high-waisted trousers and dress shoes. O'Doul did not expect to turn Cooper into a major leaguer, but he joked, "We'll make him look like one for the camera or I'll break his arm." O'Doul brought his sessions to the ski resort in Sun Valley, Idaho, where the Coopers had a home and what had become a fashionable getaway for celebrities like Ernest Hemingway, Cooper's closest friend, and Clark Gable. In late January, the weather was so warm they trained on a patch of ground clear of snow. One day, O'Doul said, "Bunch of soldiers showed up. One of them, a sergeant, came over to Gary and saluted. From one sergeant to another, Sergeant York." The studio saw the Cooper-O'Doul sessions as promotable fodder, one of many aspects of the production that were enthusiastically hyped by William Hebert, Goldwyn's crafty publicity chief. Some releases were fanciful, some were based on verifiable fact, and some were a hybrid of both. Describing the first day of filming at Wrigley, Hebert wrote that a microscope would be required to see the differences between the transformed ballpark and Yankee Stadium, an exaggeration given the differences in size and design, and the movie magic that was yet to occur. Hebert played up the notion that Cooper was learning baseball from scratch. It was a great hook for a publicist seeking every drop of ink he could get. All red-blooded American boys and men in love with the national pastime knew how hard it was to play baseball, let alone convert all hitting, throwing, and catching from one's natural side to the other one. The arduous task of turning a star of Cooper's magnitude into a left-handed copy of Gehrig almost defined the hero's journey, at least in Hollywood. Wrote Hebert, "Cooper attempts a form of mimicry infinitely more difficult than anything he has to do as an actor." Rousing success in the great Cooper experiment was declared in a yarn discovered in Hebert's fat publicity file for Pride, which detailed an astonishing occurrence at 11940 Chaparral Street, when a titanic clout flew out of Gary and his wife Rocky's estate. It was more than Ruthian or Garrigue-esque. It was Bunyan-like and crashed through a window in Tyrone Power's house. Presently up the walk of the Tyrone Power home came a tall, sheepish man with a baseball hat, the release began, and described Cooper's walk of shame to Powers' front door. There he was met by a well-informed housekeeper who could only have been conjured by a studio's central casting or creative publicist. "I told you this was going to happen, Mr. Cooper," she told him, as if she were a disgusted manager taking his ineffective pitcher out of a game. Cooper scratched his head, took the ball, and looked at the hole in the library window. "Didn't think I could hit it this far," he said, aghast at what he had done. The maid reminded Cooper of a similar smash of his a few days before that crashed through the Powers' patio window while Tyrone and his wife, the French actress Annabella, were having breakfast. Power was almost conked in the head. Cooper apologized in the hesitant manner known to his fans. The story, fabulous already, climbs a higher rung of studio fiction when the maid tells Cooper to direct his dingers elsewhere.
"Why don't you knock it over in that direction toward Jesse Lasky's house?" she said.
Here now was a maid who either subscribed to Variety or eavesdropped on industry gossip. Her suggestion that Coop aim for the Lasky house suggests a level of cattiness that your average housemaid might not exhibit. Lasky and Goldwyn were hardly friends. They were former brothers-in-law, but more important, the low-key Lasky had helped engineer the bombastic Goldwyn's ouster from the famous Players Lasky studio a quarter century earlier.
"Reckon I'll have to," Coop said, "and I'll pay for the window."
The scene evokes the opening scene of Pride when young Lou's long hit smashes a delicatessen's window, requiring his mother to pay the deli's owner. Maria Cooper Janice, Cooper's only child, considered for a moment the story that her father, in just a brief period of tutelage by O'Doul, clubs a sort of meteor shot associated with Mickey Mantle. She said that if her father were even capable of such a batting feat, he and his sidekick O'Doul had to have been in the South 40 of the family's 7-acre property to be reasonably close to Chaparral Street, a fairly wide street that the blasted ball would have had to cross before it passed over the Powers' driveway and crashed through their patio window. "It might have been apocryphal," she said, with understatement. That's an excerpt from The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and The Making of a Classic by Richard Sandomir. And he was my guest earlier on the Book Nook. And I hope you'll tune in tomorrow for the Book Nook at 10:30 tomorrow morning. I'll be talking to Katja Pantsar about the Finnish way. Have you noticed all the books about Scandinavia and how people do things in Scandinavia, and we should be inspired by that? Well, Katja has written about something called Sisu, the Finnish way, finding courage, wellness, and happiness through the power of Sisu. And just by coincidence, there's another Finnish book out right now. It's called Pants Drunk, Kalsa Rikani, The Finnish Path to Relaxation, Drinking at Home Alone in Your Underwear, by Miska Rantanen. We're not going to be talking to her about Pants Drunk, okay? I didn't mean to tempt you with that, but we won't be. We'll be talking about the Finnish way tomorrow morning at 10:30 with Katja Pantsar. And you've probably heard of hygge. That's what the Danes have. The Swedes have lagom. The Finnish have pants drunk. And they also have sisu. And if you go to our WYSO website, wyso.org, you'll see a vast archive of Book Nook interviews that we've got compiled on the website. Over 460 interviews right now you can listen to as podcasts anytime you like. And if you're on Twitter, usually on Friday or so, I will mention what's coming up on the Book Nook, and I also mention when podcasts are posted on the website, new podcasts. So you can follow me on Twitter if you like. It's at BookNookVic, V-I-C-K. That's at BookNookVic on Twitter. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.